Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Why would someone think there was a conspiracy behind Stanley Kubrick's The Shining? Or be terrified of the Screen Gems logo? Or wake up in the middle of the night believing strangers from another dimension were trying to communicate with them? These are the kinds of questions Rodney Asher asks in his documentaries Room 237, The S from Hell, and The Nightmare. This is part two of our interview. You'll hear about Rodney's films, his career, and the resurrection of an unfinished Andy Kaufman album.
So the hotel that is the exterior, that's the one in Colorado, right?
No, you know, there's like three hotels that can maybe have a claim of being the real Overlook Hotel. In Estes Park, Colorado, there is the Stanley Hotel, whose name is a funny coincidence.
Oh, yeah.
Which was the hotel that Stephen King stayed in on the last day of the season, where that inspired The Shining.
Right.
And which has really taken ownership of The Shining in a way. Like, they have a film festival. They're now a horror film festival. And they have, like, they sell a lot of Shining merch
in the lobby
and in the bookstore.
Yeah. They, typewriter ribbon, yeah.
They shot, they, on Channel 42, they show The Shining on a loop all day, every day.
Wow.
So, I mean, they shot the Stephen King written and produced, McGarris directed TV miniseries of The Shining
with
in the
Stephen
90s. There.
Weber, is that his name?
Yeah, it was Stephen Weber.
The six-part.
Yeah, and what's it, Rebecca De Mornay.
Was that any good?
It's pretty good.
I never saw it.
Well, you know, it's clearly a correction,
right,
so to speak, to the movie that features certainly a lot more about alcoholism. Which is you know, a big theme of the book and a big thing of what Stephen King was going through.
Right.
You know, that one, you know, one of the, you know, many issues I think that Stephen King had with the Kubrick movie. And you actually see Jack doing some work around the hotel.
Actually being a handyman.
Yeah, because he doesn't do nothing in the movie.
No.
He you see him like on the roof fixing tiles and he's making an effort. And he drives into town to go to an AA meeting.
Oh, wow. Do they tear down the hotel in the miniseries?
Oh, that would be telling.
Is that how it is in the book? It's more close to the book, right?
It's much closer, but you can never be a completely faithful adaptation. And what's really good about the miniseries, especially if you have it on DVD, listen to the commentary track, which is with Mick Garris, the director, and Stephen King. And Stephen King talks a lot about how personal and autobiographical that story it was.
No wonder he was mad.
Yeah.
About the...
Yeah, so... we were talking about hotels that claim to be the real hotel.
Right, Stanley.
So the Stanley is a white wooden hotel, and actually, if you have the hardcover first edition of the book, that's the hotel that it looks kind of like a V.C. Andrews joint on the cover. And the hotel on it is based on the Stanley. Then there is the Timberline Lodge in Oregon, which they shot some helicopter exteriors from at the beginning. So the exterior of it looks like the Timberline. And then they rebuilt the front of it in the back lot in London for the scenes where the characters are walking around. In the interior, a lot of it is based on the Ahwahnee Hotel in Yosemite.
Interesting.
I'm surprised that no one has... Is that carpet pattern reproduced now as a commercially available carpet pattern.
Well, I don't know about like huge rolls of interior model of certainly as like a collectible, like the guys at Mondo, the like you know, have like bath mats and clothing and floor mats and small, like, you know, small carpet. That pattern has certainly been exploited commercially. And there's like a high-end version of that Apollo t-shirt that I think Coach made. It's like a $1,200, you know, like couture, like sweater.
Of the Apollo 11 sweater?
Yeah.
That Danny's got on? That's a pretty sweet sweater.
Yeah, well, you should see the Coach one.
Yeah.
It's really nice.
Now, growing up
for a little, for a special someone in your life.
Were you a huge Kubrick fan going into this?
Oh yeah. He was always, you know, one of my favorites, and when I was first getting into movies, you know, one of the first directors who I knew by name and whose work I would kind of, you know, associate, you know, the movies together.
I think did 237 come out around the same time that show was it LACMA, the show that was the Kubrick? Did you go to that thing?
Oh yeah, no, of course.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Or MOCA or LACMA.
We certainly debuted. We did our festival tour before then. I think it was. It was around
2013.
Yeah, it was around the time, you know, that we had our theatrical release. You know, which again felt like, you know, I started becoming obsessed with coincidences in the wake of that movie, and the more you pay attention to that stuff, the more it starts to happen.
It's true.
So, I mean, that was not an insignificant one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And did you know about that show at all?
I remember hearing about it. I remember wanting to go, and I didn't go to it.
It was amazing because it was also like they would kind of juxtapose like other artworks that were similar to things. Like they had like this black painting that was like right next to like that was like the monolith in one room, or like, you know, like someone's, I think maybe Rauschenberg or something about space shuttles. To go with 2001 through.
Do they have that Arbus photo of the twins?
I think. I don't remember. They have the dresses, right? I think they hung the dresses.
They hung the
up.
Dresses of the twins from the movie. But, like, there's that Arbus photo
of the two girls.
Of two girls.
Yeah. Which he's referencing, kind of, right?
I have to believe.
Yeah, because that predates it. Yeah.
I don't know that I've ever heard him. I ever came across an interview where he commented on it, and he knew Diane Arbus.
Okay.
There's,
and he was a photographer starting out.
Like as in high school, he was like a photographer for Look magazine. He was kind of a prodigy. You know, as a still photographer.
Wait, so Diane Arbus, right? She has a photograph of the two twins that are in the movie.
Of a pair of twins holding hands that was kind of eerie.
Yeah,
and you wouldn't be blamed for looking at that photo and believing it was the inspiration for the twins.
I've definitely seen that photo and been confused, and like it made me think of that.
It predated the movie.
It definitely predated. Yeah.
Interesting. No, I never got to see that exposition, but I really wanted to check it out.
I think Kubrick's copy of the novel where he's making notes on it of things
that's
he should change.
That
was, but I mean, you couldn't flip through it, obviously, but it was like behind glass, but that was the kind of stuff they had there. They had this whole room dedicated to a project that he never did about, I think kind of about the Holocaust. I think that's what it was.
Yeah. I think it was the Aryan Papers. There might've been more than one. And I'm showing that this has been a couple of years since I was deep into this.
Yeah.
And there was a whole room about Napoleon too.
Okay,
which is one that came, you know, kind of close to getting made.
As a storyboard guy, all the storyboards for AI were pretty interesting.
They were cool.
Yeah, because that's I guess what Spielberg was referencing.
Well, you know, it's hard to say how much of it, you know, he reinvented from the way that Kubrick was going to do it. You know, but that concept art was really beautiful. And Chris Cunningham had done work thinking of what the robot kid was going to look like with Kubrick before he died.
What are some music videos that you worked on? You said you worked on music videos other than this.
Yeah, I don't know. Some of them are on YouTube. Yeah. I'm not sure how many of them that I would
want to encourage people to go to.
Yeah.
It's a work for hire more situation.
Well, I mean, a lot of them I was happy to do, but, you know, I don't know that, you know, sometimes, you know, your ambitions are higher than your abilities.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, so I don't necessarily think that I got them where I wanted them to be, mm-hmm. or where I would want them to be yeah. today in retrospect.
Right. Well, when I brought up the thing about not having live action, I was thinking about more like in opposition to how heavily The Nightmare is a yeah. live action film. So maybe that's maybe more of the direction. Like, what made you? I guess you have all this background in all kinds of filmmaking.
Sure.
But you, I watch it and like this is basically kind of like an both those movies. I guess all three of these things. Well, S from Hell, Room 237. Nightmare, it's kind of about like the unreliable narrator, right? It's like you just kind of also like the thing you're saying from UCB or improv, right? Like just what take this world literally, like whatever mm-hmm. the world someone's thinking of, take it as seriously as you can, and then you'll see what comes out of that, and the humor might be in there, or not that that one's really humor
yeah,
oriented.
In broad strokes, I think that's fair. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly those projects were about trying to put the audience into the heads of these people to get them to see the world the way they mm-hmm. see the world. Mm-hmm. You know, I did a 10-minute video about Gene Simmons that was a pilot for a TV show that never quite came together. That was going to be maybe a little like The Kid Stays in the Picture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was...
Oh, yeah.
Robert Evans.
Sure. Yeah, well, and, you know, and that's an amazing, amazing, amazing movie. And it is not necessarily 100% confirmed that this is the way all these things happened.
It's right. It's a memoir, kind of.
It's
right.
a funhouse yeah. trip through Robert Evans' mind and his experience. Mm-hmm. You know, and so, you know, the Gene Simmons thing was, you know, let's look at it. And it was based on his autobiography. It was like, let's look at the world through mm-hmm. his eyes and try to take that as far as it can go.
Yeah.
You know, which is an approach, I guess, that, you know, I'm especially interested in. Mm-hmm. And it also maybe gives me a way of indulging, you know, it gives me plausible deniability that I can deal with a subject, you know, and say, that's not necessarily, that might be me, that mm-hmm. might not be me.
Right, yeah.
But, you know, I get to play in that world without mm-hmm. having to say, this is my point of view.
Every scene, there's an impossibility. Like the TV doesn't have a cord, or even something simple as like them, they bring too much luggage up. Jack glances over at a pile of their luggage that they brought, and it's about the size of a car. I mean, a lot of it is jokes. Like they're taking the tour, they're crossing the street from the maze to go check out the garage, like a car is just about to hit them. And then it cuts right before.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Are you a fan, first of all, are you a fan of Errol Morris?
Oh, sure.
So your films remind me a lot of Errol Morris's films, especially the way they're laid out. Like Room 237 reminded me a lot of Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control.
Okay.
The way the found footage.
Yeah, found footage and the way it's separated by the people with specific opinions and by the who they are and their personalities and stuff and how it's approached. And also by what you're just saying about plausible deniability. Like there's a little step back from the filmmaker who's like, I'm just presenting this. I'm not saying yes or no to any of this. And you can make up your own mind. But there's also a little wink. I feel like there's a little humor involved. Like Errol seems to have a great sense of humor.
Sure.
So were you influenced a lot by his movies in the past, or is it, or are you just a fan and this was just something that?
No, I'd say there's a real influence, and you know, I would take it further that the way he shot the reenactments in Thin Blue Line made a big impression on me.
Mm-hmm.
Even things as simple as a, you know, very simple geometrically composed shot with a black backdrop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you talked about that Calumet can shot in 237. That's directly inspired by like the milkshake tumbling.
In the Blue Line.
Yeah. In A Brief History of Time, where they show the coffee cup falling off the table and shattering.
That stuff made a, you know, both of those qualities made a huge impression on me, and so did. You know, and so did The Kid Stays in the Picture.
Yeah.
You know, and the attitude of The Kid Stays in the Picture. You know, and the deniability thing, it's like, you know, I guess I get to step back a little bit, but it's also, these people's opinions are more interesting than mine. You know, my point of view about most subjects is, I don't know, not always, you know, amazingly original.
If we can drill down just a little bit.
Okay.
You said the black backdrop.
And
you said it elicited an emotion. What is that emotion?
It's kind of like vertigo.
Oh.
You know, it's kind of like confronting the void.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes back. And The S from Hell is there too. It's like when I would see something like the early computer graphics in The Electric Company, or the Screen Gems logo, I didn't have the words to explain it as a little kid, but it felt kind of like it would happen, you know, at the end of a show and before the next one. It felt almost like the cracks between, like if there was a second where the signal dropped out, and then you got to see the powers that be behind the television, you know, like the alien electronic dimension that's controlling this machine.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing the machine code. You're seeing through the matrix. You know, it's like your eyes open up in the matrix. You know, which is why, you know, there's that monologue at the end of The Nightmare, and when, you know, Chris was saying it, you know, in his apartment in New York at, you know, 1 or 2 in the morning. I knew that was the end of the movie when he was saying, you know, this sleep paralysis has done very bad things to me, and I'm afraid it might even kill me because of, you know, its effect on his breathing. But it's been worth it because it's allowed me to see things that other people can't see. It allows me to look beyond the veil. It's like I can see reality with the cellophane removed.
You know, that was a question I was going to ask you, too, is like when you have movies where you're developing a story based on other people's telling. Yeah. How do you know when you're done? Like it seemed like you would have hours and hundreds of hours of great things that you could use. Like when do you know when you're finished?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think that's the same thing with anything. You know, I'm not a comic, but, you know, I know guys are working on their 5 minutes or their 30 minutes. Or, you know, it's like, well, you can just write something new. How do you know when, you know, the sets, you know, it's like it kind of feels done. I mean, I think part of it is also about trying to narrow your focus. You know, if Room 237 was not only about people's interpretations of The Shining, but was also about the history of how they made The Shining, you know, if by limiting the people we talk to in Room 237 to audience members who had who had these ideas about what it was about, it made it easier to kind of get your head around what's the point we're trying to make, you know.
Rather than like someone who was working on set or something like that.
Because, you know, there's an endless amount of things that you can talk about in relation to The Shining.
Mm-hmm. Were there more than just those five
people? Oh, there's more every day.
Okay, yeah.
I
got an email yesterday.
You did?
No.
From someone who has an opinion that differs?
Yeah, well, it's kind of really it's another idea about the moon landing thing. Yeah.
Yeah. My buddy, so we asked people if they had questions for you on Facebook, and I got a bunch. My buddy's a big moon landing faked guy.
Okay.
Really his question was, and I really liked it, was why, in your opinion, why wouldn't Steven or Stanley Kubrick put in hidden messages or coding into The Shining? What would prohibit him from doing so?
Well, nothing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lack of ambition. Lack of time.
I don't think anyone's accused that guy of a lack of ambition.
Well, I mean, because you only have to go... You go to his very first film, first feature film, Fear and Desire. It doesn't get a lot of play. Have you guys seen it?
No, I have not.
It's, it's like a World War II movie. It's like five guys go on a mission. They attack like a German base on the river. And he has the same actors playing the Americans and the German officers that they're attacking.
Oh, wow.
And, unless you want to say that this is a solution to a budgetary problem.
Right, right.
You have to think he's doing something metaphoric.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And... Secret Messages has a nice ring to it, but I think we're really just talking about metaphor and allegory.
Mm-hmm.
And, almost every, most movies have that in them,
True, yeah.
And certainly he had them in from his first. And when he worked on, and if you look at Lolita, there's so much wordplay and puzzle making in that movie.
Yeah.
I mean, there was in the book.
Right.
And there certainly is in the movie. Even things like, they stay at the Enchanted Huntress Lodge, and then there's a play that Lolita is in. I should know this, but it's like those words kind of rephrased.
Got it.
There's game playing, there's metaphors, there's right. wordplay, there's puzzles, lots of them.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the way The Shining ends with that photograph. It's presented as kind of a rosebud moment, only, it's not an obvious answer to a question. It's not the end of The Sixth Sense.
Right, mm-hmm. right, right.
It doesn't say this is what was happening all along. It's a puzzle, like everything. I mean, look at 2001. He is asking you to interpret these movies. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Why wouldn't he? Of course. You can pick and choose what you think he's saying when, but I think it's pretty hard to argue that that there are metaphors at play in most, if not all, of his movies.
So you're continually still getting people emailing you about their ideas, but when you guys were making it initially, was it like? How did you find the individuals to interview?
Well, we started with a couple, and then some appeared as we went.
Mm-hmm.
Like
John Fell Ryan is one of the guys.
He came in really late.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually John Fell Ryan is interesting because Jonathan Lethem, the writer, has written a lot about Stanley Kubrick, though he hasn't written much about The Shining. And I met him at a reading. Mm-hmm. And I talked to him a little bit and corresponded with him. Mm-hmm. And he turned me on to...
Is he the Corrections?
No, yeah. He's the Fortress of Solitude.
Fortress of Solitude.
Mm-hmm. And an amazing book and one that's relevant to 237, the Ecstasy of Influence, where he talks about, collage and plagiarism and remixing. It's like a series of it's a book of essays. It's a great book.
Check it out.
And he said, there's this guy in Brooklyn who's showing The Shining forwards and backwards, at the same time.
Oh.
And I said, well, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
And for me, you're asking like, how do you know when you're done? It's like, I did, you know, I had to make peace with the fact that we're not going to be able to talk about everything that people think The Shining is about, and we're not going to even talk about every scene in The Shining, but we want to try to talk about the scope of, you know, to kind of pick up some of the major ones and the different ways that people do it. And the forwards backwards thing is great because there's sort of a evolution of the way that people wrestle with The Shining. You know, first they saw it in the theater, you know, and you may see it once or twice. I think Jeffrey Cox says he saw it like twice in the theater, you know, and then people would watch it again on VHS, and then, you know, cable or Blu-ray, and then it seemed like the end of the road is, you know, you digitize it and you manipulate it and you look at it in different ways and you transform it yourself, mm-hmm. you know. Remix, so like yeah. showing it forwards and backwards, you know, is something that you never could have done in 1980.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, and that's like the way that people are dealing with it today. And, you know, if you saw like The Chickening, people are continuing to manipulate it and add to it and squeeze it and, you know, take ownership of it.
Yeah.
You know, as a way of trying to deal with it.
There was a great, like, I don't know, maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago, you might have even seen on YouTube, someone made The Shining into a trailer
for
a dad-son. It was The Shining. It was like a really, yeah. and they used Peter Gabriel's, like, just climbing up on Salisbury Hill.
Yeah, sure. No, that's great.
Yeah, it was
recut. Yeah, it to
super
look
hilarious.
Like yeah.
Well, and I think that's significant. I mean, he picked The Shining, you know, for... You know, I've never met the guy or talked to him, but him doing it with I think there was a contest, you know, for doing a trailer that kind of, and it might have been as explicit as, you know, give the film a different emotional quality, or it might have been just make a new trailer. But, you know, he picked going with The Shining is a good choice because everybody knows The Shining.
Yeah.
And there's something to say that everybody knows The Shining because he was very conscious of the fact that it was going to live on VHS, and you know, if you want to, and the whole aspect ratio letterbox thing, like The Shining is like the only movie in the world where to go from the widescreen of cinema to the narrower screen of standard definition TV, they didn't cut off the left and right sides. And sometimes they cut off the left and right sides and then move across.
Mm-hmm.
Pan and scan.
That, yeah.
What he did was to make the widescreen of the film, they actually cropped the film plate of what they shot originally. And that's the way they typically do it. Like a 35 millimeter film frame is actually closer to a TV frame. But in the widescreen, there's a crop in.
Okay.
There are different ways to do it with, you know, anamorphic
or
whatever.
You do it in camera.
Yeah.
Right, right.
And sometimes you'll look at, if you have like a print of a film, if you look at the top of the screen, you'll see like microphones and stuff inside. Because like the director will look through the eyepiece and there's marks that says, this is the widescreen crop, this is the TV crop.
Oh.
And if you're like, if you're filming something for TV, you make sure that this part of the picture is clean.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because with all the light and gear, when you're making a movie, it's actually hard, I think, sometimes to get the entire film plate clean.
Mm-hmm.
So you only work within what you're going to use.
Right.
But he made the plan to keep the top and the bottom always clear so that they opened it up bigger for VHS.
Mm-hmm.
So you see the complete left and right frame that was in the theaters, but you also see a top and bottom that was cropped.
Wow. So in the theater, you were missing that.
Yeah, which is why you can see the helicopter shadow on the VHS or in the DVD that you didn't see in the theater, and some people think that's a mistake, or some people think it's intentional.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just a way of saying, it's a very complicated way of my saying that he was very conscious of the fact that people were going to see this movie on television after it finished its theatrical run.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to make the television experience as good as possible.
God.
And then it became one of the first like really big VHS movies.
Yeah.
And we had started, I can actually remember that this question started because of this trailer of the guy who used Salisbury Hill.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, he would use The Shining because The Shining was a movie that everybody has seen.
Yeah.
And I think it's also the reason that we used The Shining in 237. We could have done a movie about people's interpretations of lots of stuff.
Right.
But The Shining is kind of the sweet spot between like an ambitious art movie and a mainstream success.
Mm-hmm.
So Dude used it. Everybody recognized it. And I think it's an amazing demonstration of the power of music, which Stanley Kubrick is incredibly sensitive to. Like when one of the interesting, I don't think that we did this, that we showed it in the film, but during a lot of the interviews that I did, people would describe Kubrick as participating in the same practice that they do. Like Bill Blakemore said, I see Kubrick as sort of a journalist. I'm a journalist, and I think he's a journalist. And, you know, I'm a historian, he's a historian. I'm this. And, in fact, Jonathan Snipes said, I kind of see Kubrick as, like, the greatest music supervisor because he has amazing taste in music that he would choose to play with the film. And, you know, often he uses a track, and that's what the track will be remembered. You know, Thus Spake Zarathustra now... theme from 2001.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, in Beethoven, like in
Clockwork Orange,
you know, Ode to Joy or whatever.
Oh, and what he did to Singing in the Rain.
Yeah. Right. Yes, what he did to Singing in the Rain.
When you're talking about the cropping stuff, I was thinking like, what if it's also going to be this thing. The next step's going to be VR, right? Virtual reality, 360.
Sure.
I'm just trying to picture like Kubrick working in, if he had been able to work in 360, like how dense those things could have gotten. But I mean, it's just going to be happening. Like the next generation of film is going to maybe go that way. Maybe it'll be novelty like 3D, but I think it's going to be a new area.
People are, you know, people are working hard. It's interesting because, you know, I've been watching it. I've been looking at a lot of them. And we're at such an early stage. It's kind of fun that it's like the technology more or less works. Mm-hmm. And because a lot of the viewers are based on smartphones, a lot of us already have it,
mm-hmm.
you know, but they're still figuring out, is this a movie or is this a video game? Is this some other thing?
Is it a Kiki wipe? You know, like it could be like what all of the VR stuff just feels like gimmicky.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, well, you know, and I think you're right. For me, the most successful stuff I've seen is the simplest. Like, I've seen a couple narratives which, like, technically they're doing some interesting things, but I haven't gotten involved in them.
Mm-hmm.
There's, like, a documentary that's just, I mean, it's barely a documentary. It's just, like, four or five vantage points in Syria. Like, here we are in a town square. Here we are in a temple. Just kind of look around and say, oh, I understand what it's like to be here. I give a sense of this place.
Mm-hmm.
There's one of a Paul McCartney concert, you know, and I'm, you know, not the world's biggest Paul McCartney fan, but it was like a big concert. He's doing Live and Let Die, and it's like, this is what it's like to be on stage next to Paul McCartney.
Oh, cool.
And it's one next to him, a shot backstage, a shot from the front of the audience, from behind the drum kit. It's each one just sits there for a minute, and you're just kind of hanging out.
So, about the nightmare, I was reading that you experienced sleep paralysis, and that got you interested in making this, or what's the origin of that?
Yeah, well, yes, I experienced it.
Are you experiencing it right now with this podcast?
This would be a completely different sort of it. But
love it.
When it happened, it was a long time ago. You know, it was... it was in the 90s when the first time it happened. And yes, that's the reason that I decided to make a film about it. Though it hadn't happened recently. It hadn't happened, you know, within years from when I started to make it. But it is a topic that I remained interested in and, you know, started researching again, you know, as 237 was winding up. And what was kind of amazing to me was how much more common it was than I thought. Because, like, when it happened to me, well, when it first happened, you know, I didn't think that this was a sleep disorder of some kind. I thought that, you know, this was the devil coming to get me.
Right.
And if I was looking for help, I wouldn't have looked in a psychology book or a sleep studies book. I would have, you know, looked in the Bible.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so I didn't think that this had happened to more than, you know, a half dozen cursed souls. But as I started to look at, you know, after I found out what it was, that there was a name for it, and there's like a chapter in The Nightmare called It's a Thing. And it seems like for, you know, I've discovered that when it happens to people in a similar way, they think that this is a crazy thing that has only happened to them. And there's a comfort in knowing that it's a thing, it has a name, it happens to other people. There are suspected causes and suspected cures. So when I started researching it again, I was just kind of astonished how many people it had happened to. And then also its connections to a lot of, you know, both literature and history. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something to say that, you know, it's responsible for a lot of folklore, superstition, mm-hmm. religious traditions, Frankenstein, Dracula, the succubus, possibly Salem.
Oh, interesting. So are we speaking of about the sleep paralysis or the nightmarish part of it, or both?
Well, both.
Okay.
You know, and in particular, the visions that you see that feel very that feel completely real.
Yeah. My anxiety level is rising drastically just talking about this, because I've experienced this. That's one of the reasons I wanted to jump into this. I haven't necessarily had the sleep paralysis part, but I've certainly had the disembodied voices and a figure that I've seen, like the shadowy figure.
What did it look like?
It was a dude, tall, skinny dude.
Mm-hmm.
And it usually has, like, other people. There's other people there as well. It's not just one person. But it's definitely a kind of, I couldn't describe the face, but I could certainly tell you about the feeling.
Sure.
Of having someone in your room going, get up. You know, you have to get up. We have to get out of here. Mm-hmm. And being like, what the fuck? You know, I've woken up in the hallway before, like, in a fighting stance. Mm-hmm. And like, oh shit, that was just a fucking dream. Like,
but like sleepwalked into the hall.
Yeah.
So it's like almost the opposite, right? Or is sleepwalking considered in the same?
Well, you know, I find the science kind of slippery, mm-hmm. And it goes above my head real quick. But it makes sense to me mm-hmm. that sleepwalking is the opposite. That the mechanisms in your body to keep you from moving too much while you sleep, if they don't work well, then you're a sleepwalker. Mm-hmm. And if they work too well, you can have the sleep paralysis. I mean, I also, you know, if I was a defense attorney, I might have tried a sleep paralysis defense for Oscar Pretorius when he said that he was sure that there was an intruder in the room.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
When he shot his girlfriend.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, and I've got no reason to think that he was suffering from sleep paralysis, but it could have been a good alibi.
Yeah.
Because there are occasions like this in which you are completely certain that there's an intruder in the room. And sometimes it's a supernatural mm-hmm. shadow person or giant spider, but other times it's like a more normal person.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So Paco, did this happen multiple times for you?
Oh yeah.
And on, like, when's the last time it happened?
Probably a year ago, a couple of years ago. I've had a change where I sleep. Mm-hmm. Like, if I change the direction of my bed, I have a lot of sleep problems, sleep issues. So, like, I've noticed if I change the direction of my bed, it helps a lot. If I don't have things on my wall, it helps a lot. That's why in none of my bedrooms I have anything on my walls.
Oh, interesting.
And one way I can immediately cure it is sleeping on the floor. And I sleep on the floor a lot.
On your side or on your back? Side. Does it matter?
No, always side. Hmm. Yeah. But if I sleep on the floor, it never happens.
Yeah, well, you know, in the movie, there were people who would try different things. Like, they would use the TV.
Right.
You know, and which was...
That seems bad to me.
I'm a fan. I have to sleep with a fan. Or I can't sleep.
You know, there's a Judge John Hodgman podcast where they talk about... I think in Germany and an Asian country, there's like a superstition about having a fan on you, especially like while you're sleeping.
Oh, weird.
Yeah.
I don't trust Germans or Asians? Japanese.
Well, they're the entire Asian continent.
Yes, exactly. Except for George.
Yeah.
Well, I trust you.
I'm not that old school.
No, you're not fans. Old school.
But also, like, it's like somewhere like I've been to like Taiwan where I'm like, I just need a fan on all the time. But I think I have heard something about that. But when... Did you have, so do you have multiple cases of this happening?
Well, I had this one crazy horrifying one.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, you do know, tell.
Well, compared to the movie, it's not that dramatic. I was in bed and I couldn't move, and this shadow person came through the wood, out of the woods and through the door of my house and leaned over my bed, and I thought it was going to, you know, drag me down to hell.
Oh, no. Wait.
This is in the 90s in Florida?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it's Florida, yeah.
Yeah. There you go, right?
There you go.
It was Marilyn Manson.
What did you hear? What did he say? What did
he
you do?
He didn't say nothing.
Whoa. But you felt
But I felt like he was judging me.
Uh-huh.
Like he was saying,
You haven't done...
Is this one good enough? Or is this one bad enough? You know, it has... You know, or I'm attracted to this one for some, you know,
right.
There's something, you know, there's,
you've been picked for some reason,
or, you know, I called it due to my own, you know, bad choices.
You summoned the demon from the woods.
And, their skin, was, like television static. They were, tall, kind of thin. These kind of thin limbs and these long fingers. And they had these very simple faces, almost cartoonish faces of, you know, these two inky eyes and this big, like, inky smile on their face. This kind of, they were tickling me. Couldn't, you know, I was paralyzed. I couldn't move it. I couldn't stop them. And they were laughing about it. There was kind of like laughter, like, ha ha ha, like there, you know. And bars, these two anthropomorphic things, the windows.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles, just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
I just wanted to ask you about working on the Andy Kaufman recordings. You had 80 hours of audio?
Yeah, and I think at the end of the day that me and Vernon Chapman are the only people who've listened to all 80 hours. And, you know, I, what we put together, I think, was kind of an interesting project. But in a way, I wish that there was a version available where people could just hear the whole thing. Because for me, when I was, before, you know, I started cutting it, and I was just listening to see what was there. You know, I was working, I was doing like some Photoshop freelance job, and I'd listen to like 4 or 6 hours of it a day on headphones. And it was an amazing form of like time travel. You know, it's because he doesn't do any, on the original tapes, there's no place setting. He doesn't say, all right, I'm Andy Kaufman, this is the day, I'm going to mess with my friend, I'm going to do this, and here comes George, and here comes Paco. He's just on, and he's just doing stuff. And sometimes he'd play a character and mess with people, mess with strangers, some kind of proto-Borat stuff in a way. But other times it would just be on, and he's recording phone conversations with, like, old girlfriends and...
his grandma or something.
He'd go to his grandmother's house and just talk with them, you know, and just record them asking him if they can make him tuna fish sandwiches or get in the car and drive to a restaurant with them. Or, you know, there was a time where... like his friends showed up at his house and took him to a birthday party. And it's just going on in real time. It's like you're spending like 3 hours at a birthday party, and it's like the recorder is clearly like just on a table. And there are voices that you hear in the first couple hours, and it can go on. It would go on for hours and hours before you would know even the names of any of these people, mm-hmm. and then you would eventually get to know them, you know. And it would be, you know, and you're just desperately waiting for that information.
The name, yeah.
And it would be like such a relief when you're like, "That's who she is." And there would be...
You can, like, show it to Bob Zmuda and be like, "Do you know who this is?" Or something like that.
I guess we could have, but we didn't.
Yeah.
We just listened to it. You know, and, like, there's a... He goes to Times Square when they... on New Year's Eve, when they drop the ball. I think it was 79 to 80. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he just has it in his pocket, and he's there for, like, 2 hours. And, again, that's just, like, time travel.
Yeah.
Because I'm listening on the headphones, and it's not edited... You know, there's... You know, there's zero production value, but at a certain point... You know, it was like I was doing some mindless, you know, desktop Photoshop work that I didn't really need to think about, and my consciousness was just out of my body. I mean, it was virtual reality, you know, but in audio.
Yeah.
And, you know, we tried to cut together something, you know, that had a little bit of an arc, and you had a sense of the characters, and there was some comedy and some drama and some very, you know, disturbing, angry, you know, emotional confrontations. But listening to the 80 hours is a completely different experience. And
this came out on Drag City as a double LP?
As a single LP.
Single LP, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I think what happened was that...
you had to digitize everything and clean it up a little bit.
Yeah, well, they sent us digital versions of the tapes. I think his widow came to Drag City and said, "Do you think there's a record here?" Because she had, you know, the tapes in a box for years.
Yeah.
And they sent it to Vernon.
Yeah.
Because he had done, they released his amazing movie.
The Flesh one.
Final Flesh.
Which I've not seen.
Oh, it is.
He comes up, I think maybe Bill even brought him up. Yeah. You know Vernon Chapman. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Wonder Chosen.
Yeah. And Heart She Holler. Yeah. And
I think he's working on Louis' show too.
He works on both the Louis show and on the that new one. He's an incredible heroic guy. And then he produced it, and he was, you know, he was the guiding hand, and I would edit it and organize it, and it was a similar process as 237, where you know it would be like, all right, here's the bit where, like, he's at the Empire State Building, you know, asking people if this is where King Kong died, and he's doing sort of a foreign man Latka character and making himself, you know, a complete pain in the ass.
Yeah.
You know, and Vernon said, "Well, maybe cut together a sequence about the King Kong, and let's see what that feels like." Mm-hmm. You know, so it's like we would notate it too. You know, and it'd be like, "King Kong stars here at tape 14, side 2, 27 minutes," and continue, you know, till, you know, another cassette and a half side. You know, and sometimes there'd just be an hour of nothing, but really just ambient chit chat.
Yeah.
You know, and every once in a while it would kick in. You know, and come into focus. You know,
did he ever have it on during, like, a Letterman, when he was on Letterman or anything like that?
No, but he had it on when he was, there were, like, some interviews that he would do that, like, you'd hear the reporter asking
journalist,
questions.
Oh, journalist, right, yeah.
And so there was some of that kind of stuff. And he would talk about, like, getting something ready for Letterman. There's an amazing section, you know, where he talks about, like, a movie he wants to do, and kind of goes into detail.
That's so cool.
But, you know, Vernon had a really smart vision for it, you know. He said, the idea here is, let's pull from this the comedy album he wanted to do. Mm-hmm. Let's not, like, there's things that could be of documentary interest to Andy Kaufman historians, but that's not the project.
Right.
You know, there's other things that other people might be able to get from this stuff, but that's not what we're doing. We're trying to make the comedy. We're trying to extract the comedy album that was that he talks explicitly about wanting to make on the tapes.
Yeah, that's very awesome. Good.
Well, thank you so much, man.
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
Thank
Great
you.
To talk to you.
Yeah. Look forward to seeing your next project. You have so many interesting projects you've been doing.
Oh, well, thanks.
Yeah. Rodney Asher.
All right.
Yay.
And George Paco.
You can find Room 237 and The Nightmare on Netflix. Thanks for listening. You can find episodes of SupDoc on iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Please subscribe, review, and rate. For show notes or more about Paco and George's appearances, visit supdocpodcast.com. Please follow us on Twitter and Facebook at SupDocPodcast. We'd also like to thank Documentary News for their continued support. Please check out documentarynews.com. This show is produced by Will Scovel and our theme music by David Siegel.